on their hard trek overland from the steamer Rocky Mount, though a happy consequence of unloading the cabbages was the discovery of their missing sister, Ten, aged 4 years. Little Ten had evidently been living happily amid the cabbages for some weeks, missed by no one. Some victuals, of course, had to be left with stout Captain Aitken, who had stayed behind to defend his ice-bound vessel during the chill months ahead. Marooned with him were seven engagés, the old Harry Horn, Toussaint Charbonneau and his young wife Cole, Master Jeremy Thaw, too damaged from his clubbing at the hands of the late Fraulein Fretzkanner to survive a hard trek in deep chill, and the Danish painter Holger Sten, who argued that if he came ashore his paints would surely freeze, a consideration that had not deterred the American painter George Catlin from disembarking with the English party. Throughout the lengthy packing and departing, the Harry Horn, half-naked, had annoyed them all by repeatedly singing his death song, though everyone had long since stopped expecting the old chieftain to die. "Tell us, Pump, why is Mr. Glass so very angry with Jim Bridger and the broken hand?" the ever-curious Mary piped. Pump was about to attempt an answer, but Tasman, out of patience with her inquisitive sister, picked up her fork and warned him off. "We're eating, Mary, no interrogations," Tasman said. "It's hardly to be considered surprising when mountain men fight. I can think of one I wouldn't mind fighting with myself, if only he'd show himself." She meant her husband, Jim Snow, known to some as the Sin Killer, who refused absolutely to take his meals at the trading post or to sleep under its roof either. A life spent almost entirely outdoors on the raw western frontier had unfitted Jim Snow for life of an indoor or civilized sort. Walls and roofs made him feel so close that he got headaches. He quite refused, despite Tasman's pregnancy, to contemplate an indoor life, a fact that Tasman found decidedly vexing. Jim cooked his meals at their modest camp overlooking the Yellowstone River, more than a mile away from Pierre Boisdeff's well-chinked log trading post. Though Tasman would have preferred to dine with her husband, she was not about to forego Cook's excellent victuals when she could get them. Nonetheless, the fact that her husband refused even to consider coming up the snowy slope to dine with her put Tasman in a testy mood, a fact of which everyone in the post was by then well aware. At the far end of the great table, the other members of the party, George Catlin, Lord Berrybender, Bobbity, Buffum, Father Jeffrin, Signor Yanez, Signor Claricia, Venetia Kennett, and their nominal host, the tall Scotsman William Drummond Stewart, watched the ongoing struggle of mountain men against mountain man with varying degrees of interest. Lord Berrybender, sitting just across the table from Drum Stewart, as the tall sportsman preferred to be called, took only a momentary interest in the fight, though he did take care to keep his one leg and his good hand under the table in case knives were drawn. Lord B. had lately become wary of knives. Fortunately, the struggle seemed to be moderating, with no one having recourse to edged weapons as yet. The several trappers now sitting on Hugh Glass were talking to him soothingly, as if to reassure him of their friendship. Even Pierre Boisdeff had managed to rise above the loss of his crockery. He too spoke to the fallen warrior in mild tones.
"Glad there's no slicing tonight," Lord B. remarked pleasantly. "Every time there's slicing, I seem to lose an appendage. How many is it now, Vicky?"
"One leg, seven toes, three fingers," Venetia Kennett reported without enthusiasm. Venetia had not adjusted well to her young pregnancy. The trip across the frozen wastes had been for her a horror. Her cheeks were hollow, her eyes dark-rimmed, her smile now only the mockery of a smile. And yet Lord Berrybender casually assumed that she would be pleased to keep up with his ever-diminishing number of fingers and toes.
"Hear that, Stuart?" his lordship asked. "I find myself rather whittled down, although fortunately there's been no threat to the principal, perhaps I should say the indispensable appendage."
"Which would that be, Papa?" Tasman inquired. In her testy mood, she saw no reason to spare her table-mates whatever grossness her father chose to come forth with.
"Why, the organ of generation. You know what I mean, Tasman,"
Lord Berrybender insisted.
My favorite appendage by a long shot, I can tell you that.
I hardly see why you should be so proud of a mere prick, Tasman told him coolly. All it's got you is a collection of violent brats and bitches. I'm sure you know how our sainted mother used to refer to it, within the confines of the nursery, of course.
No. Why would my dear Constance call it anything?
Lord B inquired, growing rather red in the face. Tasman's shocking impertinence often took him by surprise.
Papa's big nasty, that's what she called it, Mary yelled, before her sister Buffum could drive her off with a few sharp slaps.
Thank you, Mary. You're precise for once, Tasman said.
I don't thank her, Buffum said. How painful to hear obscenity out of the mouth of a child here on the Yellowstone in the year of our Lord 1833, she intoned.
My daughter Tasman has a tongue like an asp, Lord B observed under his breath to Drum Stewart.
Don't argue with her, Stewart. Just slap her if she annoys.
Drum Stewart made no reply. He was happy at such time to take refuge in Scott's taciturnity. Though he was soon to be the 7th Baronet of Mirthley, the vast family seat in Perthshire, Drum walked with the trappers, slept with the trappers, waded in icy streams with the trappers, ate what the trappers ate, and starved when the trappers starved. He did nothing to set himself apart from the hardy group of mountain men, Bridger, Carson, Fitzpatrick, Bonville, Walker, and the Sublettes, with whom he had traveled north. Most of them were now sitting on Hugh Glass, trying to persuade him to let bygones be bygones, where Jim Bridger and the Broken Hand were concerned. His own understanding was that Hugh Glass, oldest and by some accounts wildest of the mountain trappers, had been killed by an enraged mother grizzly some years before while trapping with Major Henry's men. Clearly this was a misjudgment, since the man was alive and kicking, literally kicking, whenever he could get a leg free. Neither Bridger nor Fitzpatrick was any longer engaged in the struggle. Both stood by a table, looking somewhat stunned, as would only be natural in the light of the violent return of a man they had supposed to be dead.
You know, Stuart, it's a goddamn nuisance having to drink whiskey with my meals, Lord Berrybender complained. I miss my leg, of course, but the plain fact is I miss my claret more. Never thought I'd be reduced to a life without claret. When we fought together on the peninsula, I distinctly remember that you were a man who drank claret. No small amount of claret either. You wouldn't have a few bottles hidden away now, would you, for your private use? Come on, man, confess.
Oh, do shut up about that claret, Papa, Tasman said sharply. It's gone and good riddance. You've drunk more than enough claret for one lifetime. In any case, overconsumption explains why you're such a gouty old brute.
Didn't ask you. Asked Drum Stewart, Lord Berrybender insisted. A man who's fond of claret doesn't change. I expect you've got a few bottles secreted away here somewhere. Now, haven't you, Drum?
I walked here, Albany, Drum said bluntly. We had a few ponies, but we needed them to bring out the pelts. Can't clatter around with a lot of bottles in a country like this.
Drum Stewart did warm to the way Lady Tasman's color rose when she heaped abuse on old Albany Berrybender, and he was hardly the only man in the post who liked to hear her heap it. When Lady Tasman spoke in her spirited and witty way, all the mountain men fell silent and became shy. The purity of her diction, the flash of her wit, the bite of her scorn all fell so naturally from her lips that no one would have dared interrupt, particularly since her fulminations were often accompanied by a heaving of her young bosom. Young Carson, young Bridger, and the Sublette brothers were so smitten that they scarcely dared breathe when Lady Tasman spoke. Despite his admiration for Lady Tasman's looks, and those of Vicky Kennett's as well, Drum Stewart could not but be vexed that the English party was there. When he came to the Yellowstone Valley with the Sublettes and the other trappers, he had supposed himself to be in a wilderness so remote that it would be years before the English rich arrived. Getting clear of the English rich was one reason he plunged so eagerly into the western wild. But then, before he had been at the post even 10 days, who should arrive but Albany Berrybender himself, a man whose high title alone had kept him from being cashiered in Portugal for grand disregard of even the most elemental military discipline.
No sooner had he settled in at the trading post than here the Berrybenders came, with Lady Tasman herself driving a wagon full of servants and attendants. Old Albany, his left leg having been recently removed, bounced up in a buggy driven by an Italian of some sort. To Drum Stewart's dismay, a little England was immediately established at Pierre Boisdeff's trading post, where, to the astonishment of the mountain men, a callow American named Catlin set up his easel and began to paint the various Indians who wandered in to trade. Lordly Piegans, squat Minotaurees, wild Assiniboines from the Northland, all virtually jostling for positions in line in order to allow the American to render their likenesses. It seemed to Drum that everything he had traveled 6,000 miles to escape had caught up with him before he could even draw his breath in the High West. Far though he had traveled, he had only beaten the English by little more than a week. Already the one-footed old lord had taken to racing across the prairies in his buggy, with the Italian applying the whip to two fine mares. Albany, of course, in the normal way of English sportsmen, shot at everything that moved. Already the buffalo and elk had learned to avoid the vicinity of the post. The pot hunters had to forage farther afield every day in order to find game. That Lady Tasman had already managed to locate and marry a frontiersman, judged to be wild and untamable even by the loose standards that prevailed among mountain trappers, did not greatly surprise the worldly Scot. English ladies could always be counted on to seek out wild meat. There was little left in the East that could qualify when it came to wildness. He had to admit that he did still admire the white throats and long legs of the English women, two of whom, graceful as swans, sat at that very table, the voluble Lady Tasman and the somber cellist, Venetia Kennett. In Drum Stewart's view, there was no escaping a certain moral equation. With beauty came difficulty, and with great beauty came great difficulty. Thus he looked aside from Lady Tasman and let his gaze linger now and then on the admirably long-legged cellist. She was said to be with child, but hardly showed it yet. Lady Tasman would keep talking, whereas the silent cellist spoke only when required to. Drum Stewart was, after all, a Scot of the Scots, taciturn by nature. 10 minutes of Albany Berrybender's selfish ramblings made him want to cut the old brute's throat. "Are you fond of cabbage, Miss Kennett?" Drum asked politely. Not the least of the woman's attractions was a soft, full lower lip. On the long trek north from Kansas, Drum had largely held aloof from native women, put off by their short stature and the grease with which they liked to anoint themselves. To a man not naturally celibate, Vicky Kennett's full lower lip suggested the possibility of quickening passions and tangled bedclothes.
"She better like it. It's the only vegetable we're likely to have through this long winter," Tasman said.
She was quite aware of how frequently the tall Scot's gaze sought out Vicky.
"It'll do, sir, when there's naught else," Vicky said, allowing just for a moment her full lips to curve in a smile.
"Well, if there's no claret, we'll have to make do with brandy, I suppose, Drum,"
Lord Berrybender said. A wife wanted. Simply a wife wanted. Pomp Charbonneau had formed the pleasant habit of walking Tasman back to her camp at night, a courtesy Tasman found both reassuring and yet obscurely irritating.
"Pomp, you needn't... Pomp, it's quite unnecessary. Pomp, don't bother," she protested,
though never with much force. Not once did she strictly forbid this polished, friendly, very polite young man to take this trouble on her behalf. Tasman liked Pomp very much, and yet why was it Pomp rather than her husband, Jim Snow, who felt she needed protection on the easy walk from the trading post to the modest camp by the Yellowstone? Why, besides that, were she and Jim in the coldest months of a northern winter living in a tent on a riverbank? Because Jim found indoor lodgings close?
"You've now bewitched our good Pomp, Tasman," Buffum said, once the elk and cabbage had been consumed.
Pomp himself had hurried over to join the conclave of mountain men around Jim Bridger, Tom Fitzpatrick, and Hugh Glass.